Folks, a couple of weeks ago, when I started this series, we had a visitor here in the congregation who was also a pastor. He was up here on holidays, very sensibly, from Sydney. If you were living in Sydney, I'd be wanting to get out of there too for holidays. Sorry, I used to live there, in case you're wondering why I'm just hating on Sydney right now. It's actually a lovely place some of the time. So, now, this pastor, friend of a friend, told me a brief story. It's about their church treasurer. He worked for KPMG, one of the biggest accounting firms in the world, and as such then, a corporation that was very aware of its corporate citizenship, social responsibilities. And therefore, with kind of the winds of change throughout many, many Western countries on different social issues, they fell into line. They were holding morning teas and, you know, wearing kind of purple rainbow tie kind of events to drive and celebrate gender diversity in their workplaces. And some of you, from talking to you, I know you have had similar things and events and stories in your workplaces. Now, this accountant, this treasurer that was at this visitor's church, he wasn't just feeling annoyed by it. He was actually feeling rather threatened by it. Because the unspoken message for him is that he, it doesn't matter what creed or religion, or unless he was willing to toe the line, unless he was willing to lay aside his convictions or at least be quiet, he might be persecuted at work, or worse, lose his job. And so it's been a really stressful last 18 months for this guy. He's had a huge call to make. What do you do as a follower of Jesus in workplaces like that? And that's actually not an uncommon story. Do you hold on to your integrity outwardly and your convictions inwardly and trying to find a way out of these kind of forced shows of solidarity? Or do you just have to preempt what's probably inevitable and just go and find a new job? It's a really, really tough call. And some of you, if you're not there already, you may be looking down the barrel of making tough decisions like these. Tough decisions with big consequences. But friends, this morning, as we have heard from Daniel 3, we can see that even that is kind of not very dramatic compared to these instant decisions that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego has had to make when they came face to face with the most powerful man in the world in Daniel chapter 3. The question for us this morning is, will we want to live for God when the heat is on? The question for them and the question for us, what happens when the heat is on? Please keep your Bibles open. I'm really going to kind of skip through the narrative relatively quickly because it's a very well-known story. If you're new to the Bible, please take the time this afternoon and read through not just Daniel chapter 3, but the whole of Daniel a few times and just get the gist of where Daniel, his predicament and where he is and the stories that it's, they're ripping yarns. They really are. Last week, we saw that Nebuchadnezzar had this dream back in chapter 2 that he dreamt of this enormous statue with a golden head, and that was him. So remember that from last week. Unfortunately, he chose to forget the part of the dream where he gets crushed. The statue gets crushed by this rock that comes to set up the ultimate kingdom that will never perish. Either that or Nebuchadnezzar had a very bad case of selective memory and remembered only the bit of the dream that he liked. So he builds this giant statue of himself anyway in RL. All right, 10 stories tall, we kind of see in our Bibles there, roughly 60 meters tall, and then insists that everybody, okay, listed there in verse 2, that the satraps, prefects, governors, advisors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all of the other provincial officials, in case we've missed any, come to the official opening and bow down before this image. That's one heck of a morning tea of solidarity, isn't it? If you were called to one of those as a public servant. See, Nebuchadnezzar wasn't a subtle man, so his invitation came with this little bit attached. If you don't come, verse 6, I will throw you in the very large furnace I've had to build to make my enormous statue of myself. It's clear Nebuchadnezzar had a sizable ego. That long list of invited guests, that long list of instruments involved in the fanfare in verse 5, which poor Janita had to read over and over again in the chapter. And of course, the modest 30-meter tall statue all gives that away, that this was a man with a huge ego. And Neb's pride becomes anger when Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego didn't show up for the ceremony. You might remember from last week, after Daniel successfully interpreted Neb's dreams to him, Daniel and his friends went right to the top of the civil service. Now, the other civil servants, now they conveniently forgot the fact that they owe their lives to these Jews. Remember when nobody could tell Neb's dreams last week? All right, Nebuchadnezzar was going to kill all of his astrologers and wise men and so-and-so, and it was only because of Daniel that they're still hanging onto their heads. But they've forgotten about that, all right, that they are just jealous right this moment at being passed over for promotion. So when the three high-flying Jews, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, opted out of this commissioning ceremony, there was a queue of people lining up to dob them in. And understandably, Nebuchadnezzar was furious with rage in verse 13. So he actually found it hard to believe that anyone would defy him. So Nebuchadnezzar kind of actually just did a double take and gave them another chance to do the right thing. When the horns and flutes and zither, lyre, harp, pipes and everything else blew, right, for them to bow down to the statue, otherwise he warned them, it's the furnace, it's the oven, it's in you go. And that's when we get to the heart of this chapter in verse 16. Read it with me. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to him, King Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we're thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to deliver us from it. Remember, just right before then, in verse 15, Nebuchadnezzar kind of almost threw out this challenge. If you do not worship the image, you'll be thrown immediately into the blazing furnace. Then what God will be able to rescue you from my hand? And they say, this God, the one that we worship, will be able to. He will be able to deliver us from your majesty's hand. Verse 18, but even if he does not, we want you to know, your majesty, or O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up. Which, of course, gets Nebuchadnezzar hopping mad. We're going to spend most of the rest of this time that we have this morning looking at these three verses, because it's actually here that we find out the why of these three expat Jews. Why do they decide to defy the most powerful man on the planet? This part of the chapter explains why they're willing to make a choice which seems suicidal, really, on the face of it, and why that didn't seem to bother them. The three friends give Nebuchadnezzar, and they give us, three reasons for their behavior. And it's in the outline, it's the three points that you have in front of you. First of all, they say they don't actually have to answer to Nebuchadnezzar because they serve somebody else. Point one on your outline. See, Nebuchadnezzar wanted everyone to fall down before this giant statue of himself to show that they served him. But Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego won't do it because they actually serve, or the other kind of parallel word in the Bible is worship, a different God. A God who has made it plain that he insists on exclusive worship, exclusive loyalty. They're not to bow down to anyone or anything else. The issue for these three here is that Nebuchadnezzar has no jurisdiction over them. They answer to a higher authority, they answer to someone else. Now, I don't know if you realise or not, but you're looking at a rigid-edge Irishman out the front here. I read up on a bit of Irish history this week, my history, because Beck actually has a Republic of Ireland passport by a rather ironic set of circumstances. And if I got in 6 months earlier, I would have been an Irish citizen too. But anyway, that's okay. It's their loss that they don't have me to call one of their people. But anyway. See, in the history of Ireland, there's been a huge difference of opinion over who has the right to rule Northern Ireland, the six counties in Northern Ireland. You have these unionists who insist that Northern Ireland should be part of the UK, right, part of Scotland, Wales and England, okay? Just ask the Scots about that. That's another interesting question there. But the Republicans in the rest of the island, they insist on that the whole island is Ireland. Now, rather famous figure, probably not so much recently, a guy called Gerry Adams, who's a politician and the president of Sinn Féin, the political party there. He brokered the IRA ceasefire in 94. He is, of course, a Republican. And he, in his time, was a British MP, Member of Parliament, for over 25 years, representing the people of West Belfast. But you know what? He never once took seat in the British Parliament. Why not? Because he refused to take the oath of allegiance to the Crown. He said this, "I'm proud." I can't bung on an Irish accent, sorry, so you just have to imagine. "I am proud to have represented the people of West Belfast for almost three decades and to have done so without pledging allegiance to the English Queen or accepting British parliamentary claims to jurisdiction in my country." And later on, speaking about someone else, he said, "What kind of leader would swear allegiance to a foreign monarch?" See, Gerry is in no doubt where his allegiance lies. And neither were Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They didn't serve Nebuchadnezzar. They weren't ultimately answerable to the Babylonian king. And so in this case, Nebuchadnezzar had no jurisdiction over them. They didn't obey Nebuchadnezzar because they serve the living God. Now, I think we have a bit of a problem here. I'm not sure we think in terms of serving anyone like this anymore. The days of Downton Abbey are long gone. The only people who serve anything now are waitresses, tennis players, or convicted criminals, all right? And that makes it really hard, isn't it, for us to kind of take the Bible seriously when it talks about serving God. But here in Daniel 3 and all throughout the Bible, it's assumed that if God is the king who made us, then we will worship him. That is, we will bow down before him. We will admit that we owe him everything, our very lives, and that we will obey him in everything because we are his. And he has every right to tell us what to do and that we will serve him because that's what subjects do for their king. When what God asks of us is exactly what Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego display for us. We are to serve the living God. And look, this is really important for us to take on board here. Here's what, if we're not careful, being Christians here in Australia in the 21st century, as well off and affluent as we are, we can simply go on about being content and secure and middle class. And that church is about enhancing our lifestyle. That following Jesus is about giving us some sort of meaning, some sort of self-validation. That it's about being part of a community where we feel we belong. We can reduce being a Christian to what we get out of it. Now, of course, there are huge benefits to being a Christian, but if that's all Christianity is as far as we're concerned, well, what happens when life gets tough? What happens when we don't feel content? What happens when we fall out with someone else here at church? What happens if, like these three friends, if suddenly following Jesus becomes scary, that it's much easier to do what everyone else is doing in the world? What happens when the disadvantages of following God start to outweigh the benefits in this life? See, that's when we need to remember that when all is said and done, God is the king, and it's our role to serve him. Not our comforts, not our safety, not our contentment. If we have no awareness of the fact that God calls us to serve him as the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, then we will have no reason to hang in there when the going gets tough, when it gets hot in the kitchen. So let me ask you, honestly, does being a servant of the living God have any place in your thinking right now? Is that how you think of yourself here at the start of another week? Does it ever occur to you that our aim should be to hear the words, "Well done, good and faithful servant, come and share in my happiness"? Really, whom do we serve? The second question, the second point that verses 17 and 18 points out or asks us is, whom do I trust? See, what these three guys say to Nebuchadnezzar is really quite incredible. You kind of think about it. Try and put yourself in their shoes and their robes and their turbans and all those things. And that's all the flammable things that's described for us, things that we just go, whoo, all right? It's there for a reason. They are on the verge of doom as they are standing at the threshold to the incinerator. And they say, our God can rescue us, but even if he doesn't, there's no way we're bound down to your statue. It's really hard to imagine anything more courageous, isn't it? Or that would wind Nebuchadnezzar up even more. So why would they say it? Simply, it's because they trust God. They are utterly convinced that they are in God's hands. Their attitude is exactly the same as Job, another part of the Old Testament, who says to God, even if you kill me, I will trust you. It seems pretty over the top, doesn't it? Maybe. Unless, of course, we really are helpless. We really are in God's hands. We really do need his help all day and every day. Unless, of course, God really is the kind of God he says he is, a God who is infinitely kind and infinitely good and infinitely wise, who is all-knowing and all-powerful. See, only that kind of God is worthy of our trust. That kind of God who really knows better than we do what's best for us. See, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they were staring at the doors of a very hot oven, but they were fully convinced that is the case, as they defy the most powerful man in the world. They knew that they were absolutely and totally helpless, but they knew that they belonged to a God who was absolutely trustworthy. So there's no panic. There's no desperation. There's no last-minute pleading and begging on their knees. They don't try to talk their way out of it. They don't make a suicidal dash for freedom. They simply trust the God whom they serve. And the funny thing is, helplessness, that actually is the foundation of trust, if you think about it. If we haven't faced our own helplessness, if we don't realize in many of life's circumstances, in the face of sin and the devil, we're in that very same place. We too are helpless without God. See, if we don't realize that, we won't actually feel the need to trust anyone, let alone God. Let's say I had a trust-o-meter here, kind of mounted on the wall at the front here. And one by one, we came up, and there's a little USB port, you know, you plug it into yourself. What would it show about us? Would it show that we trust God because we know we can't do life on our own? Or would it show up that we always have a plan? That we're the sort of person to always have an idea. We always have an out. We always have to be doing something. Look, I don't know about you, but I have a trust issue. I have trust issues. I find it much easier to try and fix things myself than to trust God. And that shows itself in all kinds of different ways. See, that's why I hate waiting. I've never liked waiting for results, never liked waiting for decisions or important news, because it makes me feel helpless. Waiting makes me feel helpless, and I don't like that. I want to do something about it. I want to fix it, not wait. And that's because instinctively I trust in me, myself, rather than trusting God. And that's what basically sin is. When you think about it, trusting ourselves instead of trusting God. But in this chapter in Daniel, God makes it so clear that the only thing that makes sense is actually to trust in him. And there's just one more thing I want to point out about this trust, this kind of brand of trust that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego display. See, they don't trust God for the right outcome. All right, that's what we do, isn't it? We kind of pray for a particular outcome, and that's right to do so, but our trust in God isn't contingent on that. You see, they simply trust God. They trust a person who has proven himself to be loving and dependable and fair and wise. In God, it's God they trust. They don't tell God how to work this out. Notice, they don't dictate the results. They don't say, we'll trust you, God, to get out of this. What do they say? We will trust you, God, whether you get us out of this or not. That's pretty amazing, don't you think? I mean, how often do we try and twist God's arm and say, look, I'm trusting you to come through for me on this one, God? Whether we're praying about a relationship or a child or our job or a project, We say we're trusting God, but we're actually just using him. We're manipulating him. It's as if we're kind of holding back all of our trust, just so he can prove that he will do what we want him to do. See these three guys? What do they show? They show naked trust, real trust. And it's based on the fact that they know God is trustworthy. So they serve God, they trust God, but there's something else going on here which is terribly important for us to see. And for them, God himself is their treasure. Point three. For these three men, God is infinitely more valuable than anything else in the world. Loving him, pleasing him, knowing him is what matters to them. They treasure God, which is why they're relatively unfazed by their own impending doom. See, all the way through the Bible, God offers us himself, doesn't he? The goal of life is that we come to know him and delight in him and are satisfied by him. The goal of all that God has done in history, the goal of the gospel, the greatest event to happen in history, is that ordinary people like you and me come to know him, come to enjoy him, and so show the world that he is the all-sufficient, all-satisfying God. American preacher Jonathan Edwards, who was really the original John Piper, said this in 1733. You might have heard it before. It's worthwhile repeating. God is the highest good of the reasonable creature, and the enjoyment of him is the only happiness with which our souls can be satisfied. To go to heaven fully to enjoy God is infinitely better than the most pleasant accommodations here. Fathers, mothers, on this Mother's Day, happy Mother's Day, wonderful things, mothers, husbands, wives, children, or the company of earthly friends, good as they are but shadows. But the enjoyment of God is the substance. They are but scattered beams, but God is the sun. These are but streams, but God is the fountain. These are but drops, but God is the ocean. There is nothing better than knowing God. Friends, do we believe that? These three guys who end up in the furnace, they believe that. And so here we are, thousands of years later, but worshiping, serving, trusting, and knowing the same God. How do we treasure God this week? Well, next Saturday, I hope you got it down your diaries, unless you've already done postal voting. It's the federal election. And some of you might be kind of, you know, watching TV with keen interest to see how it goes down. I know people who have parties, election parties. Don't bother inviting me. I find the election, slightly kind of boring. For many of us, though, the trend of not just politics but society has become increasingly alarming, hasn't it? Number of people coming out to condemn Israel Folau for expressing really what is traditional views consonant with the Bible. Look, I'm not talking about the stuff where he's breached his contract and things like that. That's a matter of law. I'm talking about people who slam him for holding these convictions and being, dare I say it, being brazen enough to express them in public. The expectation that's out there that we began this time thinking about in our workplaces, for some of you who work in government agencies and big corporations, that we would fall in line, we'd participate and agree with things like the redefinition of what marriage and even what gender means. The heat is on for us in the workplace. The heat is on in many of the places that we inhabit. How do we trust God? How do we serve God? How do we treasure God in all of this? Here's a few points brought up in a conference earlier this year that a few of us who are working on the team here got to listen to. How do Christians remain faithful to God in the face of the heat that comes from our society? Here's just a quick summary of it. Let's remember that persecution is normal. Friends, according to the New Testament, everyone who wants to live a godly life will be persecuted. 2 Timothy, that it actually has been a quirk of history that we've lived in a society built on the Judeo-Christian heritage. That's been a blessing. Don't take that as a promise, as if that's the status quo that'll go on forever and ever. See, we ought to expect persecution. And in the midst of it, remember that we serve God. Our comfort is not our God. Our being respected in society for our beliefs, that's not our God. God is our God. And so we must reject utopianism. And that's the idea, rejecting the idea that we can make heaven on earth. Utopia, literally in Greek, good place. So even Christians can think like that, can't we? Out of fear that if we just somehow side with the right party, elect the right faction, or have the right president who will fight our agendas for us, she'll be all sweet. We can keep living the way we... No, no. God is the one who will build his kingdom. And he'll build it through the preaching of the gospel, not through political agitation. We have to reject somehow that Christians just need to band together and elect this party or that party. Now, having said that, we ought to make use of our democratic stewardship. Right? That means we should take elections and political issues seriously and do our part in it. Look, now I'm not saying necessarily we become experts in Australian politics and modern history, but where we can participate in a way that will actually do some good for the gospel, in a way that makes it perhaps possible still to preach the gospel freely. As well as being Christians, we want to promote justice and mercy. I know it can be trendy with younger generations, I was there once, to give the whole thing a wide berth. But just as we share in the authority of the Australian government, that's what happens when we live in a democracy, we all share in the authority of the government. If we neglect it, we might actually share in its tyranny as well, that we only have ourselves to blame if one day we no longer can proclaim the gospel openly. But in and all, we need to trust God. Just like these three friends in Babylon, we need to trust God, not our circumstances. Don't pin your hopes on ScoMo. Don't pin your hopes on Family First or this or that party. Trust in God. Trust in the one who saves, and remember that everything we have is actually ours by God's good grace. We deserve nothing less than hell for our rebellion. So anything we have is an absolute blessing. And so in the end, we also must rest in Christ's victory. He's the King of Kings. He's the Lord of Lords. The government of the world, every authority, they all belong to him. And friends, this is a luxury that we have over Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, isn't it? That for us, through the pages of the New Testament, we've seen Jesus raised and ascended and given all authority on earth. Compared with those guys, we have a much, much better view of what God is doing in this world and where this world is going. But coming back to Daniel, with these guys, I mean, hearing this story again for some of us, except you're probably feeling about this big. The Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they really did serve and trust and treasure God under extraordinary duress. My guess is that temptation for most of us is to get depressed because we're not like them. The key thing this morning is not to look at Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Actually, it's not to look at ourselves either and get all wound up and depressed. The key is to keep looking to the Lord Jesus. Remember that bit of the story where Nebuchadnezzar sees this extra man in the furnace? The Bible, the text doesn't actually tell us who this is, although the king's guess is, it's probably one of the sons of God, or an angel or something like that, verse 25. All we know is that this figure is able to rescue these three friends, and they come out without even smelling of smoke. Who is this figure? We don't know. Could it be an angel? Yes. Could it be God the Son in a pre-incarnate mission? Yes. Does it really matter? No, not really. The point is simple. God will send a rescuer who can do whatever it takes to save his people. The only way we will be motivated, in fact, to follow in the footsteps of these three friends, to serve and trust the treasure, is actually to look to Jesus. He's the one who's actually going to supply us the ability to do that. We need to be confident in him. We need to rest in his victory. Are we half-hearted? Are we inconsistent? Are we weak? Are we slow learners? Yes, we are all those things. But in Jesus, help is here. So let's face the fact that we can't live for God without him. Let's run to Jesus. Let's gaze at him. Let's treasure him and trust him and serve him.